The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hey, I thought this shit was pretty dope, eh? But, kick another roller for the homeboys, eh?
Alright, look, man. I'ma kick the first verse. But for the rest of this shit, man, you won't have to wait for album 3, loco. Mi vida loca.
Everything looked like a tornado hit it. Clothes, toilet paper, smash TVs, drink cans, some shit that looks like cotton candy blowing around but can't be.
When she started to cheer, you could hear the murmuring start, the speculation from the guys and the girls, and maybe even from some of the parents.
What was that time like? You know, what were people wearing? What were they listening to? What did it smell like? Over 11,000 fires.
I read a story in the newspaper. The way the story was told originally was that she had been bullied to death by a pack of teenagers.
That's when it hits me. I'm staring at a war zone in South Central.
We looked around, and we could see Mrs. Moore. We couldn't tell if she was even looking at the field. She didn't clap. Her hands were full.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead. We're speaking this week to two writers who both found their inspiration in headline news, but whose treatment of the stories they tackled could not be more different. The springboard for Sarah Bannon's debut novel, Weightless, was the story of an American teenager who killed herself after falling foul of cyberbullies. It was a tragedy that was to send Bannon on a journey back into her own high school experience. Together with painstaking research, the song that you hear now is one from a soundtrack that shaped Ryan Gatiss's gripping six-day journey through the 1992 LA riots in his novel All Involved. We join Gatiss and gang boss Big Fates at the dawn of day two of the uprising.
I walk over to the TV and slap it on. Dial down the volume and retreat back to the couch, expecting the same as every other half-wise gangster in LA, you know? Straight law and order. Like, cops out in full force with their vests on, locking shit down. Sheriffs throwing shackles on fools and slamming them into caged back seats so they can haul their asses off to process. Statements, fingerprints, photos, jail. You know, just a bunch of thuggish motherfuckers in uniform running a big-ass net along the streets and scooping up the idiotas. The drunk ones, the drugged up ones, the ones that stayed way too late at the party, and now they gotta pay for what everybody else did. But when the screen hums on, and the crispy tube static fades, a picture forms all those blobby colors getting mashed together. A picture forms when they sharpen into shapes, into city blocks, into running people. Into running people carrying shit. And I don't see what I'm expecting, not even close. I see the exact fucking opposite. And I blink to make sure I'm actually seeing it jump off in Compton, where all kinds of shit is laying in the streets. Everything looked like a tornado hit it. Clothes, toilet paper, smash TVs, drink cans, some shit that looks like cotton candy blowing around but can't be. There's busted glass everywhere, on sidewalks, over curbs, and into the street, looking like shiny confetti you never want to touch. And fires. There's fires in garbage cans, fires in mini markets, fires in fucking gas stations, man. There's fires on top of fires, and they're spiraling into the sky like they're holding it up. Table legs, I call it. That's what the smoke looks like. The news switches to a camera on a helicopter, and the sky, man, the sky isn't even blue or that halfway kind of gray we get on the worst smog days. It looks like wet concrete. A gray so dark, it's almost black. It looks heavy as fuck. That's when it hits me. I'm staring at a war zone in South Central. It's like somebody packed up all the shit I've been seeing in Lebanon my whole life, put it in a box, shipped it over, and opened up that chaos in my backyard. It's Gaza Strip. La neta, Holmes. And this whole entire scene says the same to me as it says to every other knucklehead who ever thought bad thoughts across this whole city. Now's your fucking day, homie. Felicidades, you won the lottery. Go out there and get wild, it says. Come and take what you can, it says. Devil's night in broad daylight, I call it. 'Cause the world we live in's completely flipped now. Up's down, down's up. Bad is fucking good, and badges don't mean shit. 'Cause cops don't get to own the city today. We do.
When I read it, I thought this is an HBO series waiting to happen. And the way you read that, you know, you've sort of totally got the voice, and presumably you have in your head lots of different voices. Was that in your mind when you were doing it?
Absolutely. And I think in a way, speaking was actually part of my process. You know, I spent so much time listening to people, and I have an aural memory, A-U-R-A-L. And sometimes when I hear things, I kind of visualize how they look. How do the sentence structures look? You know, what are the main components? What makes that tick? What are the slang words that push these things forward? And I don't know. I just found it so fascinating, and in many cases, poetic, brutal, truthful language. And also, as I was writing it, I would write as much as I could during a given day. Then my wife would get home, and I would read it to her. I would kind of use her in a way, her ear and her sense of a story, just to check and make sure I was kind of going in the right direction. And she has a background in criminal law and used to work for the DA's office. So in some cases, she actually knows a lot of this world better than I do.
You also have a soundtrack to it. music is something that comes up in your work a lot, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's mainly because I find music so inspiring. You know, sometimes I'll hear something and I will either conjure a scene or already have a scene in my mind. With this book in particular, obviously, as it's historical fiction, I was restricted to a certain era. And so I found myself asking essentially everyone I came in contact with, what were you listening to? What was part of the sound of the neighborhood? What were other people listening to? What do you remember? And I just found that process the most fun in the world to really help describe LA through music. And Motown was a huge part of the Latino communities then, and it still is now. So that was a part of the book. And just moving forward, I mean, I would occasionally even listen to songs over and over again while I was writing. And in some cases, the scenes would change a bit based on either things I was hearing or a direction I got pushed in. It's hard to say. I wish I could be more self-conscious about it, but it just gives me energy and I just go where it takes me.
As well as the Latino community, which we would expect in LA, there's a big Korean contingent.
Yes.
One of your central characters is...
Yes. John Kim, End of Day 2, he ends up in a car squashed in the middle of the back seat with his father and a man from his building and, I guess, two mutual acquaintances as they drive around basically being vigilantes. Now, the reason why I chose to tell that story is because I was so, I think, saddened and confused by the law enforcement response at that time, which was they knew that the gangs were coming up from South Central and they were going into Koreatown. So what they did instead of protect Koreans and the Korean-American citizens there, they actually told them to leave. And then they left. And I think it's one of the great American stories that perhaps isn't told enough, where the Koreans basically said, no, we're not leaving. We've worked very hard, you know, for our businesses and our homes. And more importantly, there are some older people here and some young kids that can't leave, that don't have that option to go. So the interesting thing about it is, you know, the men who were over a certain age and came from Korea actually had compulsory military service. So all of them knew how to handle weapons. And as a result, they made this incredible last stand at the end of day two and completely discouraged gangs from coming in. There were a few casualties, but by and large, they did a phenomenal job. And I guess the thing that I found just the absolute irony is that law enforcement went back in, LAPD specifically, and started arresting mainly Korean men for possessing weapons without permits.
Has it been read in those communities, to your knowledge?
Not yet. I mean, I know a few folks and they're trying to pass it around, but I've not yet heard any kind of community response to it. But, you know, with any luck, more folks in LA will be reading it and hopefully adding their voices to the discussion.
Do you feel a responsibility to the people whose stories you're telling?
Well, I'm not telling anyone's story in particular. I told people, hey, I don't want to know what you did. I don't need to know what you did, but talk to me about what that time was like. But as far as feeling an overall responsibility to these communities and people in LA, in some cases who aren't as represented, certainly in fiction, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why I spent 2.5 years researching it and went back and back and back to, you know, the folks who were most valuable to me and provided so much insight and pushes in the right direction. That being said, I think it's interesting. I mean, there are bits of me in every single character. And I suppose perhaps I'm outing myself as a creative writing lecturer a little bit in that, you know, I never tell my students to write what you know. I say write a bit of what you know into something you've researched and make it live and be passionate about it and move forward with it.
All Involved is your third novel. And
yes.
Quite different from the other ones.
Very different.
In that it is, you have gone into the heart of a really violent historical incident, which is very close to the heart of sort of the United States mythology of urban trouble, really.
Yeah. I don't know. I suppose when I first looked into it and even considered writing about it, I just thought, surely someone has already written about it in fiction. Just because there's so much written about it in magazines and newspapers and nonfiction books, I thought for certain there was something, but from what little I could tell, there wasn't. And then I have to admit, right after that, I felt this enormous responsibility to get it right, or at least as right as I could.
Why did you think you had the right to write about this? Because because you're dealing with Latinos and Koreans, and yeah. Here you are, you're a boy from a military family from a completely different area of the
yeah.
States.
Well, it's interesting, I think, because being an outsider actually helped me meet a lot of these people. Initially, I thought it would be a detriment. But going into some of these places, LA is quite fractured. And if you're from one neighborhood, you might have conflicts with other neighborhoods. And the fact that I didn't have that history allowed me to go in. The fact that I work with a street art crew in LA gave me a certain amount of clout, I suppose, and allowed people to talk to me. And beyond that, I think it was just a matter of sitting down with people and, you know, obviously making it very clear, look, I don't want to tell your story. You know, I'm not here to listen to that. You know, whatever you might have done, especially with the former gang members, whatever you might have done, I don't need to hear about it. However, what was that time like? You know, what were people wearing? What were they listening to? What did it smell like? Over 11,000 fires. What did it smell like? How did it feel? You know, these were the kinds of questions I had, because I suppose as an incredibly selfish novelist, I was far more interested in capturing the spirit of the time. And I think when it came down to it, when I sat down with people, I made it really, really clear that, you know, just by telling my own story of violence, of what happened to me, you know, when I was 17 and I was hit so hard in the face that it tore my nose out, I had to have 2 facial reconstructive surgeries, and I didn't really smell or taste for almost a year after that. Believe it or not, telling that story and connecting with people, many of whom had been through similarly painful incidents, really helped to connect us as humans and in many ways earn respect and eventually trust.
So this is, you have decided on a form or a structure, which is to tell the 6 days of the riots in 6 different stories. In the proof copy I had, which was absolutely wonderful, it was 6 little booklets in a box from the perspective from 17. So it's 17 first person narratives over covering 144 hours of this immense turbulence, which was kicked off by the Rodney King incident, which we all still know about.
Well, it was actually this bit was kicked off by the fact that the 4 officers who had assaulted King were found not guilty. So when they weren't found guilty and the, you know, basically everyone in the city who felt as if justice hadn't been done, then they went out into the streets.
So why did you decide to tell it like this?
I think initially, the first character I wanted to write about was Payasa. Once I'd written her, I knew, oh my gosh, you know.
So Payasa is the sister of the first victim.
Yes, that's correct. The second narrator on day one. And I knew I had to tell the stories of her brothers. She's one of three children. And once that happened and I saw how that kind of laid out, it was almost short, long, short, the way that structure occurred. I just felt like, wow, this works as a novella. And oddly enough, I think that really allowed me to relax and say, I think I have the form here for each day. And that's how I proceeded forward. There were three narrators on day two, day three, day four, day five, and only two on day six because the curfew ended early. And I just thought, well, you know, maybe that's the right way to end it.
So going back right to that first scene, which is, it's an incredibly shocking opening. You have this, you're drawn into the head of this young man who's just clocking off work from a taco van. He's total innocent. Walking back through the city, he happens to come from a gangster family and he gets killed.
Yeah.
And his body lies for 2 days until a nurse gets somebody to take it away because the city authorities are too busy to actually...
Yeah.
Take a body off the streets. Is that actually true? Did that sort of thing actually happen, or is that novelistic invention?
I'm making a face right now. You know, I think it very well could have happened. I've certainly heard stories of things that weren't done quickly. And the reason why I wrote it the way I wrote it is simply because Los Angeles is too big. You know, in these riot areas, it sucked all the emergency services, all the police, all the ambulances, all the firefighters up there. And it left these incredible vacuums in these other areas. So in Linwood in particular, and we do know for a fact that the coroner had tremendous difficulty picking up bodies. Whether or not they stayed there for 2 days, we don't know. What Gloria actually does in the book is call private ambulance company and have them pick it up. And, you know, what I did is... I certainly had to figure it out from a plot standpoint, but I mainly talked to firefighters who run EMS and EMT services in LA. And I said, hey, how would this happen? What is the best way for this to make sense? And, you know, they really made suggestions that allowed me to make those fictional jumps and connect it together.
Mm-hmm. So by the end of this first section, Ernesto has narrated his own death, which from a purely storytelling point of view is quite a bold thing to try to do.
I'm glad you didn't tell me that ahead of time. For whatever reason, I think it just felt right. And I followed my gut. Perhaps I had the virtue of ignorance, you know, and in that respect, I just had connected so much to the character. And I was already terrified because I only have maybe 10 or 12 pages to build a character and then have him go through the worst thing that ever happened to him. And ideally... elicit a strong emotional response from the reader, and that's a heck of a task to try to pull off. But I think I just went with it. I mean, I have so much, having spent so much time in Linwood with people, with families, you know, having sat down to dinners and having heard stories of siblings or aunts or uncles who had passed away, you know, it just felt like something electric as I was writing it, and I did my best to capture what I know so many families have gone through in that area.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Ryan Gattis. All Involved is published by Picador, and you can find Ryan's full playlist on the front page of this podcast. If you're coming to us through iTunes or SoundCloud, you can find it by searching for Guardian Books Podcast. Sarah Bannon's character, Carolyn, is also the victim of social violence. But in Weightless, the damage takes a more internal form, as she told Richard Lee.
I read a story in the newspaper, like a lot of other people did at the beginning of 2010, about a young girl named Phoebe Prince who tragically took her own life. And the way the story was told originally was that she had been bullied to death by a pack of teenagers called the South Hadley Six. And quickly, over time, a more complex story emerged. It wasn't quite clear. This happened in South Hadley, Massachusetts. And Phoebe herself was an Irish girl who had moved there when she was 15 years old. And she was beautiful. She was really talented. And in the beginning, she fit in. But over time, things fell apart for her. And as I say, I read the story and it haunted me. And then I read further stories about it that showed a much more complex picture of what had happened to Phoebe. She had suffered from depression in the past. She had attempted suicide before. And one of the things that was just very distressing about the case was the element of cyberbullying involved. But anyway, so I read that, and as I say, it was very upsetting. Then I thought about my own high school experience, and I moved to a small town in Alabama when I was just 13 years old. And it was a culture shock for me, for sure. I had great experiences, I had great teachers, a great school, but it was a strange place. And I think I knew for a long time that I wanted to write some fiction about that time. So I started to think about a character, a girl called Carolyn Lessing, who would come to a small town in Alabama, much like the town that I grew up in, and chart her life over the course of a year. So it was all those things, and then my imagination, and then the characters kind of started popping into my mind based on those two things.
I mean, the girls are brutal. I mean, they're really very vicious indeed. They're judging appearances to a standard that can only be achieved by actually abusing your own body. They're kind of holding each other up to this kind of ridiculous ideal. And they're being, as you say, really horrible to each other remotely and in person.
Yeah. I mean, the characters in the book, and I mean, I suppose the one of the things about being a teenager and a teenage girl is that you pay a lot of attention to your body, to your physical appearance. And it's one of the key ways that we judge one another. And I think, you know, perhaps this is slightly heightened in the novel. Perhaps these characters are saying things that we all think ourselves, so perhaps it's not so heightened after all. The story itself is really there to ask the reader some questions. And I suppose I started the book with a series of questions in my head. You know, what are the tiny hurts that we inflict on each other every day? How much impact do those actually have? And all of the characters in the book have a backstory that gives them a certain amount of complexity and gives them a certain amount of vulnerability. But instead of being kind to one another about it, they end up being cruel.
Do you think that this is something that's shifted over the last 10, 15 years with the rise of digital technology in particular?
I think that bullying and attention to physical appearance as a guide to popularity, that was certainly there when I was in high school. That was certainly a part of life. What's new are the ways that people go about it. So one of the things that's very frightening about cyberbullying or social media for people of like my generation or older is that we didn't grow up with it. We don't quite understand it. It's also frightening because you can't really turn it off. So a kid has something bad happen to them at school, they come home, and then it follows them there, and it's 24/7. The upshot of that, or the only good part of that, is that there's now kind of a record of what happens to a kid in these kind of situations. And I think that might be part of the reason that there's such a cultural preoccupation with bullying at the moment. I think we have more concrete evidence of actually what's happening. And I also think parents are maybe a little bit more concerned with their children's happiness than maybe they were 20, 30 years ago. There was a sense, I think, when I was growing up that, you know, ignore it, it will go away, this is character forming. But I think now we're looking at this and seeing some really serious cases like the ones I described before and thinking, well, maybe this is too much and maybe we should try to put a stop to some of this behavior.
I was surprised to see one of our regular reviewers on the children's book site recommending Weightless for those, as she put it, over 12 because of the themes of self-harm and suicide. Do you have a kind of readership in mind when you were writing the book?
I suppose when I wrote the book, I never thought it would actually be published, so that's the most honest answer. But I actually thought it was an adult book when I was writing it,
And are you surprised to find yourself striking a chord with teen readers?
No, I suppose not, because I think teen readers read all kinds of books. And I think some of the categories, you know, I think they're useful in some ways for bookshops and for reviewers, but they're slightly artificial in a way. So I'd be really happy if a 16-year-old picked up this book. I'd also be happy if a 36-year-old picked up this book. I think because it deals with teenagers, of course, it will appeal to teenagers. But I was trying to explain this to someone the other day, and I was saying, I think, you know, it's a book for people of all ages. You don't have to be a teenager to appreciate it, in the same way you don't have to be in a toxic marriage to appreciate Gone Girl. So that's my view.
It's got a very bleak trajectory. There's almost kind of, I don't want to give too much away, but the ending doesn't wind itself up all tied up neat in a bow either.
No, and as I said before, I think like one of the things that I was trying to do in write the novel was not to provide pat answers. One of the things that journalism can do, and particularly 24-hour news cycles, is it can present a story neatly and it can give us a set of facts. I think what fiction can do is ask some questions and reveal a bit more complexity. And, you know, when I started reading about some of these real life cases of contemporary bullying, thinking about my own experiences, I just thought, well, actually, there were a lot of people culpable for lots of things. There were a lot of people hurt. There were a lot of people standing by. And the issues were complex. And I think, you know, the book asked questions about how culpable someone is at 16, what it means to be passive, what the nature of memory is, the relationship between rumor and truth. Like, those are all the questions the book is going to ask, or I set out to ask. I'm not sure it answers them, but I think it raises them in a way that gets the reader thinking.
I was wondering where the voice of the narration, the we, came from.
Yeah, it came actually pretty naturally. So I have, I think the voice chose me rather than me choosing it. I wanted to convey a sense of claustrophobia. I wanted to convey a sense of the way teenagers often engage in groupthink. I also wanted to create an us and a them. The we voice also highlights rumor, gossip. There were obviously lots of limitations to the voice. You know, there were lots of things that we couldn't know. There are lots of things that the reader can't engage with. And so throughout the book, when you're reading it, you'll find that I've intercut it with other kind of source materials. So there are Facebook feeds and there are transcripts and there are newspaper articles. And this is to kind of give the reader a bit of a break from this we. But it's also to just underline that there's a difference between what we remember and what is reported as fact or kind of found objects. The other thing I'll say about the we voices, and I've just noticed this in work sometimes, I notice in work that when something good happens, I always say, or not me, other people will say, I did this, I did this great thing. But when something bad happens, we say, we are very sorry for this inconvenience, or we are very sorry for that. So I think the we voice just underlines that kind of...
the we of denying responsibility.
Totally.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the other things about interleaving your news stories or your material from Facebook or whatever is perhaps it gives a sense of anchoring this slightly disconnected narration, this kind of... Were you trying to get a sense of reality there?
Yeah, I wanted a reader to pick up the book and think that, you know, a book is kind of an artifice or a novel in a way that it is in some ways artificial. So why are these people telling me this story? And I wanted people in a way to feel like they were picking up almost an unofficial yearbook or something for the year, so that they were getting a scrapbook of what had happened. And when you're reading the novel, it becomes clear pretty early on that the narrators are looking back ever so slightly. So they're remembering things. And I guess when I was writing it, I was imagining these characters sitting down and trying to piece together everything that happened in one school year.
Yeah, you've lived in Ireland since 2000, but this is a very American story. It's a million miles away from any stereotypical portrait of Irish writing. Would you say that you are an American writer, an Irish writer, or something more complicated?
I'm probably more complicated, as my accent will attest.
I noticed you adopted a very straightforward American accent for the voice of the
book. Oh, good. I'm glad. So, yeah, I moved around a lot growing up. I'm American. I was born and raised there. And I've lived in Ireland since 2000. I'm married to an Irish man. I have an Irish daughter. I consider myself Irish American. I work at the Irish Arts Council. When it came to fiction, for some reason, I don't know that I'm just maybe a little afraid that I don't know Ireland well enough to embark on an Irish novel, even from an American's perspective. I'm not sure what it is, because I'm working on my second book at the moment, and it's also set in America. And I'm not actually sure I know the answer to the question. I don't know why I don't feel like my fiction can be there. I think I'm a little bit afraid that if I wrote a work of fiction set in Ireland now, it would be wholly autobiographical. So I don't want to do that.
Speaking as part of your day job, you said once that the only thing that identifies Irish writing is that it is good. In general, a kind of international reputation for quality. Is that because in the back of your mind you had this book brewing?
Oh gosh, probably not. I don't think I ever believed that I would be able to finish a novel and that I'd ever be able to get it published. I spent many years being just an avid reader, the best attender of literary events all throughout Ireland. No, I was definitely talking about other writers and not myself.
I'm wondering how important the subject is for you as a writer. I mean, how do you wind up choosing what you're going to write about next?
Well, for me, it seems to be what's preoccupying me or what's worrying me. So this book was concerned with a story that haunted me. And I suppose probably me coming to grips with my own high school experience. And it's a very dramatic time of life. And that seemed really good for a work of fiction. I also think for me, the subject has to have lots of questions, you know, and this book was amazing in that respect. And it had a lot of questions. The next piece that I'm working on and the next book that I'm working on, I'm a newish mother, and, you know, the questions are around parenthood and parental guilt. Surprise, surprise. But I also think for me, this with Weightless, finding the voice was the main thing. Once I found the voice and once I committed to that, actually the writing was relatively easy and it happened relatively quickly.
Brooke's eyes were so brown, they were nearly black, and she wore a white eyeliner that made them pop. We could see that, even from where we were sitting, even with her covered in shadow. She had freckles, thousands of them, but she smothered them with liquid foundation. When she started to cheer, you could hear the murmuring start, the speculation from the guys and the girls, and maybe even from some of the parents, the alumni scattered around us. Baby got back. That's at least 10 pounds. 15, easy. She went on the pill. I think she looks better. You're such a liar. Y'all be nice, just saying. Summer of Twinkies, summer of sex. Shut up. The uniform was two sizes too small. That much was for sure. And we heard later that her mother had bought it as a kind of motivation for her to drop the weight. Brooke was tall. Her legs were longer than Gemma's whole body, we guessed. And when you're 5'8" and you put on a few pounds, a cheerleading uniform isn't kind, we overheard Miss Simpson saying later. Whatever, we thought. Her routine was faultless, really. Arms tight and rigid, clapping in straight lines just below her chin. She did candlesticks and raise the roof and arabesque. But her size was distracting. Brooke was still beautiful, this much we knew. She'd even done some modeling for our local department store, Parisians, and a couple of years ago, in the Galleria in Birmingham, she was scouted by an actual agency who wanted her to come to New York for some interviews. Why she didn't go, we weren't sure. Some people said this proved the scouting never happened, and others said it wasn't a modeling agency at all, that she hadn't been scouted, but that she'd gone to Birmingham to audition for Survivor or Big Brother or Paris Hilton's BFF or some other reality show, and that she'd gotten a call back, but that they couldn't afford the airline ticket to New York. But that didn't seem likely either, we thought. Brooke Moore wasn't that poor. It was just something people said. Whatever the truth, Brooke's features were flawless. Her skin had never seen a zit, not even a whitehead. She was a Neutrogena ad, we said. She hadn't always been tall. In elementary school, she'd been one of the smallest in the class, and she looked even smaller because her hair was always long, almost down to her waist. And she wore it in braids sometimes, and you could be hypnotized by the cords of brown, some parts glimmering like pennies, other parts smooth like a Hershey bar, weaving in and out of each other, and tied with a perfect purple bobble. Brooke always wanted to have it cut. She begged her mother to let her get a bob, something short she could tuck behind her ears. But her mother refused, insists that girls were meant to have long hair, that Brooke's prominent chin, her slightly crooked nose, all of this would be exposed with the wrong haircut. A bob would be unforgiving, she was overheard saying in Winn-Dixie, in church, at the country club, to whomever had just complimented her on her daughter's beautiful hair. When she was 10, Brooke rode her bike to a hair salon, to Cutting Edge or Just Cuts, or maybe it was even Sam's, her allowance for the past 6 months stashed in her pocket. She brought a photograph of Jennifer Aniston's bob and one of Tiffany Thiessen's shag. Her mother arrived before the scissors came out and the cut was aborted. Her braids stayed for years. We watched Brooke now, her hair just shoulder length. A battle had obviously been won somewhere in the last 5 years. And her chin didn't jut, we didn't think. Her nose looked perfect to us. But we'd heard Mrs. Moore had been exploring plastic surgery options for Brooke over the summer, had even been to the bank to see about a loan. Something about a deviated septum? And we wondered now if liposuction had been added to the list. She was the fattest of all the cheerleaders. That was obvious. She'd probably go back to her pseudo-bulimia, we said to each other. Not enough self-control to be Rexy. The uniform was too tight all over, but it looked the worst in the chest. She was huge, had gotten even bigger over the summer. We'd heard before that she had to special order her bras from the web. Nobody carried 32 triple F or whatever freaky size she was. We wondered what she was doing for underwear now. Somebody behind us said, "Her boobs look like something out of National Geographic." And we laughed a little because we knew what they meant. When we were 12 or 13, when everybody was just getting training bras, Brooke was already stocked in Victoria's Secret, and she'd come into school wearing a white shirt with a red bra you could see underneath. Brooke finished her chant, and people yelled and clapped and called her name. Fat or not, she was still popular. People loved her. We looked around, and we could see Mrs. Moore, not sitting in the bleachers, but standing on the side of the parking lot, a cigarette in her left hand, a Diet Coke in her right, platinum hair catching the sun, and even from a distance, you could see it was perfectly set. She wore sunglasses that obscured half her face. We couldn't tell if she was even looking at the field. She didn't clap. Her hands were full.
Sarah Bannon there talking to Richard Lee, and Weightless is published by Bloomsbury. We always love to have feedback on this podcast, so please do get in touch. You can find this week's instalment by searching for Guardian Books Podcast or visiting the Guardian Facebook page. Thanks to Sarah, Richard and Ryan Gattis. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Eva Krishak. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.